Good morning, brothers and sisters. When I was young, during the time my mother homeschooled us, she used to have several of her female friends from St. Aloysius over on like a Tuesday or a Wednesday or a Thursday, I can't remember the day, and they would pray the rosary together, and they'd bring all their homeschool kids too, and there'd be, you know, a couple of dozen of us running around the Miller home. Well, one day in particular, I remember this very clearly, I'm walking through the living room, and the ladies had finished their rosary, and they were just talking about Father's homily from the previous weekend. And one of them says, I overhear one of them saying, "Do you know, Father used the S word in the homily last weekend." Now, I'm 13 years old, I'm walking through, and I'm a little confused. Like, I'm not sure, I don't remember Father using the S word in the homily, so I turn and I say to my mom and these ladies, "I didn't think Father said sex in the homily at all." And they looked at me shocked. "Not sex, sin." So I was a little confused. Now, for those of you who know me, I talk about sin all the time. So you're kind of used to that, so it's not surprising. I assume at that time it wasn't a word that Father often used in the homily. Well, since I use it so much, I decided instead of talking about sin today, guess what I'm going to talk about? Exactly. So, for all propriety and just for everybody's sensibility, we'll just call it intimacy. There we go. Easier pill to swallow. So today, what I wanted to talk about in particular was the sanctity of intimacy, of marital intimacy, as it's come to us through the teachings of the scriptures, through the teachings of the church. Now, we as Catholics in a particular way have a great desire to end the scourge and evils of abortion in our society and in all cultures throughout the world. We realize the great sin and evil that it is to kill any innocent person, let alone the weakest and most innocent of people, children in the womb, the unborn. And yet one of the mistakes that we often make as Catholics ourselves is assuming that we can, in fact, fix the problem of abortion in our culture if we don't first fix the problem of contraception. And why is this? Because abortion is merely a symptom of the use of contraception. It's just a symptom. And if you don't deal with the root of the problem, there's no way to actually stop the symptoms. When you go to the doctor and you say, I just want something to take away the symptoms. I don't want to actually get better. I mean, maybe he's got a drug for you. I don't know. But is that the right approach? Certainly not for us. Now, how is it true that contraception, artificial contraception, is in fact the root of the problem of abortion? And I would say not just abortion, but in fact all of the sexual problems we have in our culture today. The rampant homosexuality and the approval of homosexual marriages, gender identity and fluidity, all of these things stem from contraception, period. Now, when the church document, Humanae Vitae, was written, officially clarifying, under the authority of the Pope, the teaching of Christ on the use of artificial contraceptives, clearly it wasn't widely accepted and loved in the world. Even many Catholics were a little surprised by this. In fact, most thought at that time, even Catholics, that the Pope was going to say it's okay, at least in certain circumstances. But he clearly came out against it as intrinsically evil, meaning that to use contraceptives in the marital act is always gravely offensive to God, meaning, again, that one can go to hell for a single act of doing it if they die unrepented. That's how serious the church's teaching is against it. Why? Think about it from a worldly standpoint for a moment. What's the big deal? If you have two married, consenting adults, and neither of them want a child from this particular act, who is it hurting, right? Like, if we set aside the type of contraceptives that are abortifacient, meaning they cause abortions, well, then you could justify, well, they're not killing the baby. right? They're just preventing one from ever existing. Who is it hurting, right? Don't they have their own freedom and rights as a married couple? It's not society's job, it's not the church's job to tell them how to live their married life. That's really the argument that we get most of the time. Who are you to tell me what I can and cannot do? But the very simple reason why the church and why Christ teach so clearly on this issue has nothing to do with any strange moral law. In fact, you can set morality aside. Let's just assume there is no heaven or hell. There is no God. There is no judgment on the soul. Let's just assume, for all intents and purposes, that doesn't even exist. Would it still be wrong to contracept? Absolutely. Why? For one simple reason, it's unnatural. It's not natural. Do you remember back in the day, and they still use it, but back in the day, that phrase, going green, everybody used all the time, and it got to the point I was just sick of that phrase. Oh, we have to go green, we have to go green. Yeah, fine, I'm all about recycling and that kind of stuff, but please. But I realized I needed to use the phrase, in my own way. And so whenever I was preparing couples for marriage and I would talk about contraception, I would always tell them, you know, you have to go green. You have to just be natural, the way God designed it to be. You don't want anything artificial, anything distorted in this natural act of intimacy. Nature tells us what intimacy is for. Nature does. Scientists can discover this on their own. It's really quite simple. The marital act, the act of intimacy, is primarily for the purpose of what? Procreation. That's it. I'm not saying there aren't other goods, but primarily speaking, first and foremost, it is purely for the sake of procreation. That's it. That's just science. That's just natural understanding of the world around us. In every species that has dual sexes that procreate in this way, that's why they do it, to make babies. It's really quite simple. It is unnatural to use that act for any other purpose alone. A good way to understand this is from the standpoint of our need for food. When I was in college, I worked for an independent newspaper called The Gadfly, and we used to write articles that the college newspaper would never print. So one day I wrote one on intimacy, and I told everybody in the article, just to make this easier to receive, whenever I'm talking about food, I'm talking about intimacy. And so then I spent the whole article talking about food, because it makes a good connection. So when you eat, when you put food or drink into your mouth and you swallow it and it goes into your stomach, why do you do that? What is the point of that function, that action that you perform? First and foremost, the point of eating is to nourish and sustain the body. That's it. Now, I'm not saying that it shouldn't give you pleasure. It's always better when the food tastes good, isn't it? But sometimes, parents, you make your kids eat their vegetables, right? Because they are good for them, whether they taste good or not. So yes, sometimes it's not going to taste good, but the reason I'm eating this or that, first and foremost, is for my health and well-being. You see, if I don't eat, two things happen. I lose energy to function, and my body begins to degrade, because it cannot replace dead tissue. So without eating, I'm gone. It's not like a car. You see, a car, if you put gas in it, it can run, but if you don't put gas in it, it's not going to necessarily fall apart as long as you keep it in a garage. It's just going to sit there. You can't do that with a human. You don't put food in it, it dies, it withers, it falls apart. It's not just energy, it's life-sustaining. So when we eat, we always must, at least for the first intention, consider the nourishment and the well-being of our bodies. If we choose to eat for pleasure alone, what happens? Right? The church calls that gluttony because it's naturally wrong, it's disordered. But when we choose to eat for pleasure alone, normally what happens is we become unhealthy. I only eat chocolate cake. Why? Because I love it. It tastes so good. That's gluttony. It's only one of the many forms of gluttony. So when pleasure alone is the reason, when we divorce or remove the first and primary reason for eating, meaning for my health, from the act, then the act becomes perverted, and I become sickened by it, objectively. Now, yeah, you can get away with a little cheating now and then, fine, okay. But, generally speaking, however, nourishment and pleasure are not the only reasons why we eat. We also eat for a communal relationship, don't we? We just had Thanksgiving. I mean, what's the point? It's just a big meal. You might as well have it at home. Why do you have to go to your family's house? Why does everybody have to get together? Because it's not really about the food, is it? It's about the family. It's about the companionship. The meal is just a good opportunity to bring everyone together. Why? Because we have to eat 3 times a day anyway, so make it a meal. Bringing people together is also a natural good, an aspect of eating. Doesn't mean it has to be all the time, but it is certainly part of our act of eating food. These three goods apply as well to marital intimacy. First and foremost, the natural and fundamental good is procreation, because that's the natural end of it. Like food for nourishment, intimacy for procreation, for life. If you ever intentionally or by action reject that aspect of the marital act, you have perverted the act. Now, it doesn't mean that the other two goods aren't present, meaning the pleasure that one gets and the communal bonding that happens between a husband and a wife. That's all good stuff, and that's supposed to be there. But the moment you remove the natural good from it, the other goods become distorted and perverted. For us as human beings, our very existence depends upon this act. I stand before you because, I know you don't like to think about it, but it happened. Right? It's true. That's where all of us come from. The only ones in this world that didn't come from that were Adam, Eve, and Jesus. That's it. So 3 out of trillions of people. This is the way God intended to bring forth new humans into the world. Now, we as Catholics understand that each individual is made in the image and likeness of God, and that is true. Now, if that individual is so precious, so sacred in the world, because they image God, then the thing that brought them into the world is also sacred. It's also sacred. Meaning it's not just an earthly act, it is a heavenly act. It is a holy act in which God is involved. You know, when you pick your nose, God's not necessarily involved with that. It's not a sacred act. Sorry, it's just not. I'm not saying sometimes you don't have to, but there's nothing holy about it necessarily. But we know that God is involved in every procreative act. Why? Because he's the only one that can make a soul. You mothers and fathers can make bodies, but you can't make souls. Now, the church is teaching very clearly against the evils of contraception. And again, there are nuances in this. I'm not going to have time to go into all of it in the homily today. We'd be here forever, and I already preached long enough. So we can always talk more at other times. If you need to ask me personal questions, please just find the time and do that. But the church is teaching, formally condemning these things as evil, is primarily for the reason of protecting the sanctity of life itself. Because if you can pervert the very act that brings forth life into the world, then you pervert the image of life itself. Because there is nothing more human, there is nothing more personal than our sexuality. We're not angels. We're incarnate souls. We actually not only live in these bodies, but these bodies are us. It's not all of us, right? I've got a soul as well. But this body with its sexuality is real. But it again follows certain parameters according to the natural goods, the natural order. And when I abuse the natural order, I'm abusing the God who created that order. That's all we mean by sin. That's all we mean by sin. The Pope who wrote Humanae Vitae prophesied all of the things that would come if contraception was made legal. Abortion, not only during pregnancy, but even afterward. Rampant homosexuality, gay marriage, gender fluidity, all of these things. And do you know why he did that? It's not like God like infused sacred knowledge from the future into him. No. The reason he could prophesy it is because it's the same thing that's happened in every culture that has done this for thousands and thousands of years. It's the same thing. The church is simply teaching history and adhering to the word of God. Did you know that in ancient Egypt, long before the time of Christ, there was a plant that if a woman, pregnant or possibly pregnant, ate the leaves of this plant, it would end the pregnancy? It's what you call an abortifacient, a contraceptive abortifacient. So if she was intimate and she didn't want to be pregnant, she would just eat the leaves of this plant and everything would be taken care of. Did you know this plant is extinct? It doesn't exist anymore. Because they couldn't grow it fast enough. It was used up. It's extinct. You think contraception or abortion is new? All of the problems we have right now in our culture, the ancient Egyptians had, the ancient Greeks had, the Romans had, Britain had when it was the most powerful nation in the world. None of this is new. The only thing that has changed is our technology. But sin is sin. And the church, for the last 2,000 years, has always condemned it because it brings nothing but death. So if you really want to end the evils of abortion, yes, we can march and we can pray and we can do everything in our power to fight that. But the real thing we have to defend, not just live as Catholics, but defend, is our church's teaching on the evils of contraception. Now, all this being said, it's important that I summarize with this. That doesn't mean the church is saying you have to have as many children as humanly possible. That's not a church teaching. God has designed, in the marital act, a natural way, in normal circumstances, of arranging when you have children. It's called natural family planning. I'm not going to go into that today. If you haven't heard about this, come and talk to me. There are classes. I can teach you. It just takes a while to explain everything. So there is a way to do it naturally according to God's natural design. So nowhere does God or the church presume that you have to have X number of children. That is a prudential and prayerful judgment that you and your spouse make. And you may have very good reasons, which is why none of us can judge any of you. Because we don't know your individual case or circumstances. This is, in fact, even for Catholics, sadly, a difficult teaching at times. But I warn you, you cannot claim to be Catholic and reject this teaching. By that very fact, you deny the faith. This is one of the essential teachings of the church. There's a number of them. This is one of them. So take this seriously. If you're struggling with this teaching, if you have not yet conformed to it or repented of it, don't go to communion. Pray about it. Call me. Talk to me. Let's work on this together. Go to confession if you're able to. And then return to the sacraments. Living the Christian life is certainly not easy. It's the hardest of lives to live. But it is even more offensive to God if we hypocritically think that we can live it the way we want to. The church belongs to Christ, not to you and not to me. I'm not teaching Father Miller's teaching up here. We're here because of our conformity to Christ. If you do not want to conform to Christ, then leave. In the name of the Father, and of the Son, and of the Holy Spirit.